It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. Anglers and fishing guides got some really bad news in our region in recent weeks as the Alaska Department of Fish and Game closed king salmon fishing, including catch and release, over a broad swath of the most popular streams in the Mat-Su Valley. King salmon have been in decline for a number of years on the Susitna River drainage, but this is the most drastic conservation action yet to deal with the problem. On today's show, we'll learn about the decision and why it was made, and also the impact on anglers and the sport fishing industry, including concerns about how and when the decision was announced and the problems that created. Stay tuned. Well, with me right now is Matt Miller, who is the Cook Inlet Coordinator for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, the Sport Fish Division, and has been having a quite a busy time, I think, in dealing with this issue of closing king fishing. Now, Matt, I wanted to give you time to explain to listeners, who many of whom will be anglers, exactly what the closures are and, you know, what's happening. I mean, it sounds like it's all kind of a blanket closure, but there's some sort of differences on different rivers.
Yeah, there are. Thanks, Charles. So we had the department issued actually three emergency orders, and we'll be speaking about two of them. But the first one was for the Deshka and the Yentna River. And so what this emergency order does, and it's obviously preseason, it's for kings. What this will do is reduce the sport fishing gear to one unbaited single hook artificial lure for all the waters. And it closes king salmon fishing, even for harvest, and only allows catch and release fishing on some of those drainages on the Deshka and the Yenta. So it's roughly the more remote fisheries on the west side of the Susitna River, where we've gone to, where we've allowed some limited fishery in the past, have gone to catch and release this year. And then largely on the east side along that park's highway streams where there's more accessibility. And in recent years, we've started out at catch and release. Those are going to be closed. The second one was for the Little Susitna River, which is a separate drainage. And that also goes to unbaited single hook artificial lures. And king salmon there is a retention harvest fishery there. And that's going to be, that can be retained on Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday in the Little Susitna there. So there's some harvest opportunity there.
So for the Little Sioux, the rest of the week, no fishing or catch and release, or what will be happening on the other days of the week?
There'll be non-retention, so it's catch and release. Mm-hmm. You can fish, you just can't harvest the kings there.
So no catch and release is just about as that's the bottom scale. I mean, there's nothing left at that point. What is the reasoning behind stopping catch and release? Because we think of catch and release being pretty, you know, a pretty good conservation measure.
Right. Yeah. Well, it's no surprise. Certainly your listeners mm-hmm. have probably been out kingfishing. Everyone knows we've been in statewide a period of low productivity for king salmon, and Cook mm-hmm. Inlet hasn't escaped that. There have been restrictions for the last several years on these drainages. And what we're basing those on preseason is we have an outlook for the Deshka River. And there's an escapement goal. We manage mm-hmm. by an escapement yeah. goal. So there's how many fish we want to see.
Right, and I know this is it. I mean, we'll go through this one step at a time, so don't worry about the complexity. you've got escapement goals, you got the right. fish that got to spawn so that they can make more little fish, right? And if not enough, we can get up there. Yeah. But, I mean, I would think that catch and release, they'd usually survive, right?
Correct. We have really yeah. pretty high survival rates. Most mm-hmm. of the research is showing, I think, it's somewhere between 8 to 11%. So we usually go with 9 or 10% estimates for mortality.
Oh, really? Okay.
In this case, though, the escapement goal that we're talking about for the Deshka is 13,000 to 28,000 king salmon. And the forecast for this upcoming season is just under 13,000 fish.
So even if every single fish makes it through, you're still
going to... Without any harvest, we're not projecting to make the goal.
Wow.
Now, the forecast is just one of the tools that we use. I mean, mm-hmm. over the last few years, I think our score with that has been somewhere between 5 to 30% off, which isn't bad for preseason goals. But, I mean, there's a lot of things that can come into
right.
effect. So it's one of the tools that we use. So we, clearly, looking at where we've been in the past and where we think we are with the king salmon product, we're going to start into this conservatively. So, yeah, I'm sorry to get back to your original question, I guess. One of the considerations, of course, is non-retention and catch and release, but at some point, you know, you just have to say, look, we can't even
allow
that, right. that mortality, even right. that low mortality. And so that extra step was taken on those east side.
Yeah. Pulling back the camera a bit farther.
Yeah.
There's been a lack of kings, as you said, statewide. Do we have any idea why this is happening sort of in the big picture level? Is it just a normal long-term cycle of maybe ocean productivity, or is there something about high seas fisheries, or why is this happening?
You know, it's probably several things. Everyone kind of likes to point at right. one thing, and unfortunately, it's rarely ever that simple. There was a lot of resources poured into this through the King Salmon Initiative program, and the studies that we're seeing statewide, the thing that seems to be coming up is that there is poor survival from the smolt in that first month to a year that they enter saltwater. So they're near shore, we think, at that point, and the survival rate at that point seems to be the main issue here, and we're not sure why. The problem is we don't know why, but we think mm-hmm. that is. And I think that's largely based on some studies down in Southeast, but there's kind of the assumption that that's the issue statewide.
So this is when they're emerging from the river and they're in that that critical phase where they're really small, they're probably eating plankton and stuff like that, and then for some whatever reason, they're not getting out to sea to grow.
Correct. Yeah, there mm-hmm. seems to be a higher than we expect mortality at that phase mm-hmm. in their life cycle. And we're not quite sure, but you're right. I mean, they're pretty vulnerable at that time. They're
right.
small and still adjusting to salt water.
Right. And that's kind of a mystery then as to what's causing that.
It is.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're going to continue to look at that. But in the meanwhile, what we know is that we're not seeing them and that there's a...
We need to produce more. Yeah.
Well, we need to...
as many
we're trying
as we
to
can.
Get up there yeah. so that they can produce, exactly. But what we have control over right now is habitat.
Mm-hmm.
And fortunately, for the most part, Alaska has fantastic habitat for these fish to come back to.
Yeah.
You know, and where we don't, we're trying to take care of pike issues where they are. And of course, our, you know, habitat and folks are out there trying to put in culverts, improve culverts and bridges and things like that. But for the most part, we got great habitat.
Mm-hmm.
And then we control the harvest where we can. So we take those sources of mortality and we try to reduce them. And, you know, we've been through this before with kings and we went through it with coho. So part of it may be cyclic.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have that habitat and you can reduce and get those adults back up, they're spawning, you know, we're pretty optimistic they're going to be coming back. So we don't think this is going to be the new normal
for Alaskans.
Not the end of the
world, right, right. Yeah. But the other element, I guess, is predation. And when we think about these smolt, you know, they're probably a yummy treat for a lot of different kinds of fish. Is that a possibility that there's some predation thing that going on that's special or new or unexpected?
Yeah, I'm not sure. That's certainly a possibility. I mean, you're right. Everything out there is going to feed on small fish, right?
Mm-hmm.
And whether there's water temperature changes that are moving fish patterns as to whether it changes, whether it's changed to where the smolt, you know, once they hit the salt water are going,
mm-hmm.
or whether it's moved a different species into areas they haven't been before, I don't know. But that's all certainly within the realm of possibility.
Yeah. So one of the things about Cook Inlet, and you have a great title of Cook Inlet Coordinator, which sounds like the impossible job, right, is all this ongoing conflict for generations between the commercial and the sport folks. But the plan, as I understand it, is that you're kind of coordinating the reductions in harvest so that it's perceived as fair. And so tell me for those, and there are probably some commercial listeners too, but in terms of our sport listeners, are the commercial guys getting hit too, just as the sport people are?
Yeah, that's a good question, that's certainly one of the considerations because it's the department. The department issues these emergency orders,
mm-hmm.
and so if there's a concern for a particular stock, then you try to look at who's responsible for those mortalities and harvest. So. In addition, I'd mentioned earlier that there's several emergency orders that were done preseason. The two I'd mentioned for Deshkayent and Little Susitna, Commercial Fisheries Division also closed the commercial salmon set gill nets, the king salmon directed fisheries, and that is four periods that they had for commercial fishing. So the pain is spread throughout the different user groups. One user group that was not affected by these emergency orders was the subsistence fishery, and you know the subsistence has top priority, and so they weren't affected by these, and we'll see how it goes in season. There could be further actions, whether it's liberalizing things because the forecast was under what we're seeing, or mm-hmm. there could be further restrictions.
If more kings show up than you expect, right?
Right.
So what is the subsistence fishery? I don't really think about that as being like a king subsistence fishery around here. What is it exactly?
Yeah, there's a small subsistence king fishery. They harvest about 1,000 fish up in the northern Cook mm-hmm. Inlet.
Okay. So one of the, I'm talking to Matt Miller, he's the Cook Inlet coordinator for Alaska Department of Fish and Game Sport Fish Division, about the closure of king fishing, king salmon fishing across the Susitna drainage, really a broad and absolute closure in a lot of ways, much more than we've seen in the past. Matt, one of the concerns that's been brought up is it's sort of like, why didn't this happen sooner? You know, have you guys been not conservative enough? I guess there's the question of like previous years, maybe we're harvesting too many right. kings. Address that, and then of course after that we'll get into the issue of like the timing of this. But what
right.
Give me the sort of the overall picture, the multi-year perspective of how we've gotten into this fix.
Right. Well, like I said, I mean, people have seen this decline in king salmon production for years, mm-hmm. and we've been taking restrictions pre-season and in-season for at least the last five, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And what we look at then is we have the preseason forecast, and so we'll make some preseason judgments on that, and then we have in-season assessment tools. And in this case, we have fish wheels on the main stem, Susitna, and then we have a weir on the Deshka itself. And so we're actually, you know, looking at and counting fish so we can make in-season counts. So we have had restrictions in the past, but we haven't felt it's been necessary to take this more drastic step of closures. And, for example, on the Deshka River, the escapement goal wasn't made last year, even though we had some restrictions in place. But it had been made, I think, for the previous 10 years. So we kind of look at that, and last year I think we missed it by about 100 or 200 fish or something. So even though there were restrictions, we felt that we were still hitting those escapement goals.
But this time the prediction is below the goal. How does that prediction come into existence? I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of factors you look at. It's a computer model that looks at how many five yeah. years ago were coming up, and that's when we saw the drop-off, so that's when why it looks so bad now.
Yeah, we have research staff who are much smarter than me, and they'll be cringing right now to think I'm trying to explain how this happens. But the forecasting, what they do is they look at models, they look at, how many come back for each age class, mm-hmm. and then they come up with they look at it by age class. So how many of the one ocean fish, two ocean fish, three, four ocean fish they expect to come back. And then there's a series of models that they can look at. And so then they take a look and say, for each age class, which of these models do we think is the best fit, is going to be the most accurate? And then piecing all of those together, they come up with a total forecast. One of the interesting things about the forecast this year is that one of the reasons it's low is because it's forecasting a very low return of the five-year-old fish, so 1 year in freshwater, 4 year in saltwater.
Mm-hmm.
And if that comes true, then the forecast will probably be pretty accurate. But if, for example, we see more of those four ocean fish coming back than we predicted, then the forecast will probably be off on that, because those four-year-olds typically, I believe in this drainage, make up about 40 or 50% of the run. So it's a significant part of the age classes.
Right. So one big input of that model presumably would be what the escapement was 5 years ago.
Correct.
And that's right. when the problem was really hitting us. So we would expect, I would guess, for the next 4 years, unless, you know, maybe we have a great year this year, but I mean, right. presumably this is going to be a problem that continues for a while.
Yeah, that's a good point. It is one of the things that's a factor into theirs. Is who spawned these fish? Mm-hmm. How many of them do we expect to come back?
Right.
Another thing they look at is how the three-year-olds performed last year. And they weren't showing up very well. We saw a lot of big fish. That was a bright side on the fishery last year. Mm-hmm. But if the three-year-olds weren't showing up, they kind of figure that they're not going to come back for it. Now, sometimes they just hang out for another year for some reason. They could surprise us. But,
they do what they want to do.
They do what they want. They don't, yeah.
So one of the complaints, and obviously people are really disappointed because, I mean, not only just because people like fishing, but because this is a big piece of our economy, regional economy, to the sport fishery for the tourism and every other aspect. There's some disappointment that we're, you know, beginning of April, end of March, and we're just getting the news.
Right.
And talk about that a little bit, about why the announcement now instead of being able to announce it earlier in the winter. Obviously, there's been no new data coming in over the winter, right? Because there's no fishing going on. So why not make an earlier announcement?
Yeah, that's a good question, and thanks for addressing that one. The forecast came out in, I believe it was middle of February. And so we take a look at the forecast. It was finalized then. Come up with some preseason actions we think would be appropriate. Start talking to the user groups. We talk to anglers, to charter operators, and to lodges, and draft up some preseason action. Some years it goes through fairly quickly. This year, there was some more consideration. There was some consideration at the higher levels as this emergency order was being looked at about statewide perspectives. For example, what we're seeing down in Southeast right now. And so some of these concerns, the fact that we didn't make the DSHCA goal last year, and so some of these concerns were raised up and had a lot of discussions in-house, got a lot of feedback from different user groups, and came out with this emergency order was released, I believe, the 13th of March. So that took longer than usual. On the bright side of this, the good news is that we've been talking to our research staff about the Palmer office, and they think they can streamline what they've been doing. They've come up with a different way to enter the data. And so we're thinking now that we should be able to get the forecast out, I believe we were talking about in December, and start making these decisions earlier then. And so we should have preseason actions, if they're needed, out earlier to the public. And we think that's going to be a huge help. I mean, we get it. Not only are anglers trying to figure out what they're going to do, but as you had said, you got lodges and charter operators, and I mean, they're out trying to get business at shows and to book, and that was one of the things we heard, is that we had talked to people in February about similar restrictions to what we did 2 years ago, and then we came out with something, you know, just recently here in March that was more restrictive, and that's tough to build a business around.
Right.
I mean,
right. We
get that.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about that more later in the show, but I know that you're an Upper Cook Inlet guy, but how does this relate to what might be happening on the Kenai River and on the other drainages down on the peninsula? Are we going to see similar cutbacks, or are those functioning independently?
Yeah, that's interesting. In my position, I get to work not only with the Palmer Sport Fish Manager, Sam Ivey, up out of the Palmer office, but also Brian Marston out of Soldotna and Carol Kirkovit down out of Homer. So heading south as we go here, I mean, we've got this news up in the valley. Mm-hmm. The Kenai forecast, I don't have the number with me right now, but came out within the goal. And there's a management plan on the Kenai that's pretty tight. And so it says, if you're going to be within the goal, these are the actions you're taking. And the actions that we're starting with for the early run are what's in regulation.
Okay.
Well, those are already pretty restrictive, mind you, but
right. We
didn't need to make any preseason emergency orders for the Kenai. Then heading down to lower in Cook Inlet with the anchor, Nanilchik, Deep Creek. The forecast came out for deep, and it's at the upper end of the escapement goal. And so we are not taking any actions on those streams. Last year, for example, anchor did really well. Last couple of years, it's been performing well.
But there's smaller fisheries in the Susitna by far.
Clearly. Yeah. Well, with the exception of the Kenai.
Of course, the Kenai. No, I would say anchor and the Kasirov.
When we're anchored, Deep Creek, Nanilchik, those are all smaller fisheries.
Yeah.
Correct. And so, and again, they're all fairly restrictive to start out with.
But it's good news. I mean, it's not like universal that there's something happening in the Susitna that was more severe than what's been happening down there. Is it a management difference, or is there some environmental difference?
We're thinking it's environmental difference. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're trying to be consistent with how those are managed.
Right.
It's just, it's good indicators. I mean, certainly in season, Sam up out of the Palmer office is going to be saying, I wonder what's coming. Are we going to be getting those four-year-olds that we're looking for? And so he's going to be calling down to Homer and saying, what are you guys seeing in the marine fishery? What's Anchor and Deep Creek looking at? You know, so we kind of use these other fisheries as some sort of indication in season.
I think you hear a lot of fishermen grumbling about sort of high seas bycatch and the stuff that's happening sort of over the horizon that we can't see. Do we have a sense of whether that's a major problem that's affecting us?
Yeah, I don't know how much of a significant issue that is. I mean, it's certainly potentially an issue. But I don't know, and it's I'm not sure if any of us have a real handle on how big an issue that is.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the other species, the coho and the sockeye. Are their abundances going in tandem with the kings, or will there be some opportunity for people to shift over to other species this year?
Yeah, there'll definitely be opportunity for folks to shift over. One of the things that we did with the preseason emergency orders is that there were regulations that prohibited fishing for resident species like rainbow trout, which is another great fishery up in the up in the valley, and those were closed when you were when it was closed for king salmon fish. Those are going to be open 7 days a week now, so it's not the same. Mm-hmm. Rainbow's not a king, obviously,
right.
But we still wanted to try and provide some opportunity where we thought it was available. So the coho and the sockeye aren't tied to the fate of the king. Sockeye up in the valley are not a real big sport fishery like the kings. And the coho, last couple of years, have been doing pretty well. The problem last year, we were making gulls, but they came in late.
Mm-hmm.
And so by the time we really started getting the coho moving through the Susitna systems and drainages, a lot of folks had either gone back to school with the kids or they'd gone hunting.
Right.
And so it's good news, bad news. Good news is we made the coho goals,
but
the bad news is they came in too late for people to really get out after them.
Right. Well, we've got to change our plans to meet the fish, I guess. Well, thanks, Matt. Is there anything else you wanted to add? Because I know it's a big topic, and we probably didn't cover everything.
Yeah, it is a big topic. The other thing, though, following up mm-hmm. on the opportunity, is that we also have some fisheries, and particularly up here at Klutna. So there is some harvest opportunity on Little Sioux, like I said, and then the Klutna tail race.
Which is a stocked fishery.
Correct, it's a stocked mm-hmm. fishery. And so that one, none of the restrictions affect there.
Uh-huh.
And so there's still opportunity to go out there, Ship Creek, and then again, if folks haven't explored down the peninsula, might be a good time to get out and go check out some new places while the Kings get a break this year.
Well, kind of the talking about Ship Creek and the Klutna tail race sort of raises the idea of enhancement. Is there anything we can do artificially in terms of enhancing these fisheries to get them going again?
Yeah, we're certainly looking at that. What we don't do, and we had done this in the past, but it's not a policy the department mm-hmm. would do now, is stocking hatchery fish over top of wild fish.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we have a place like Ship Creek or Klutna where it's a terminal fishery and there aren't wild stocks nearby that would be impacted, then we'll do some stocking there to provide opportunity. But mostly the goal in that is to take some of the pressure away from wild stocks and put it on these terminal fisheries.
Right.
If we were to do that to try and kind of boost production in some of these wild stocks, you'd need to take the brood from the wild stocks, and then it becomes cost prohibitive pretty quickly.
Because you'd have to keep the genetics of
Correct.
That particular river.
Right. We'd have to go take brood from there every year and, mm-hmm. and then take them to the hatchery and then release them back.
Which you might, has been done in the distant past, I guess, when they're trying to rebuild a fishery from almost nothing.
It has been, yeah.
Right. Yeah. Great. Well, thanks so much, Matt. This has been really interesting, and I'm sure it's being a bearer of bad news is never any fun.
It's been.
You guys take a few hits.
It's been a rough week on this one.
Yeah, right. Matt Miller, he's the Cook Inlet coordinator for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game Sport Fish Division. I'm Charles Walforth. It's Outdoor Explorer. Please stay with us. We're going to be talking more about this topic, which is a really important one to people all over our region, as Outdoor Explorer continues.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and we are talking about king salmon fishing in the Mat-Su and sort of around the inlet. Summer is coming. And not with all the, not with quite as much hope and happiness as usual, because king fishing has been mostly closed in the Susitna drainage. And as we heard in the earlier part of the show, even catch and release has been halted. And then there is some catch and release in some of the areas and some harvest in the Little Sioux, but a pretty dramatic reduction in king fishing in the coming season. And right now I have somebody who is going to be severely affected by that. Andy Couch has Fishtail River Guides. He's been guiding in the Mat-Su area for 35 years. He's also in the Mat-Su Borough Fish and Wildlife Commission, and he also writes a fishing column in the summer for the Frontiersman Thanks for being with us, Andy.
Yeah, thanks, Charles. Glad to be here.
So in terms of for somebody like you who makes his living from this fishery, this must be a huge blow.
Yeah, so the king fishery is really big in the Mat-Su Valley, especially for guides and lodging, but other tourist industries, fishing tackle businesses, fish processing. Early part of the summer through July 13th, the king salmon is the primary thing that a lot of guides are working at. And when you take the king salmon out of the equation through the 13th of July, there is hardly any other salmon available in the Susitna drainage. For instance, what you might catch some sockeye, last year during the king salmon season, I was guiding most every day until it was closed by emergency order, and my guests caught zero sockeye during the king season. The year before, during the entire season, including the silver salmon season later on, the entire summer, we caught three.
So you're not going to say, well, we can't fish for king, but let's go for sockeye. This wouldn't make any sense.
Well, yeah. You know, and some people might say, well, you ought to fish for pike. You know, you could go catch pike, and pike are seen as something that eats the salmon and this is in the drainage.
Yeah.
But the way that works, when I guide king salmon trips, I already fish for pike. So I go to the Deshka River sometimes, and there are some pike over there that we can catch early in the season. A lot of times we go out and people aren't getting bites. We maybe haven't even hooked a fish, and I'll ask sometimes my guests, would you like to fish for pike? And a lot of times, maybe half the time they will, and half the time they'll say, well, you know, if we go pike fishing, we're not going to have that chance of getting a king salmon. We really want to try and catch a king salmon, so they don't do it. But when they do go pike fishing, there's one slough where we've usually had pretty decent luck, and oftentimes we'll start catching fish pretty quick. Usually the first trip of the season when we go to that slough, we catch oftentimes the most and largest fish of the season, and as it goes into the season, we keep catching less and less. And the reason is the regulation, partly. The regulations on the Susitna drainage, if you catch a pike, no matter what it is, if it's a pike, you're not allowed to put it back alive. Mm-hmm. So when we go and, you know, try and give people some other experience, something where they're going to catch some fish when the king salmon fishing is really slower, we got to kill them all.
Right.
And you don't catch them again after you kill them.
Because they're trying to get rid of them, yeah.
Yeah.
So what will this do to you as a business person? It kind of means you're out of business until, like, most of the summer, right? Unless they open it up unexpectedly.
So I've guided a lot on the Little Susitna River, mm-hmm. and the Little Susitna River will be open 4 days a week to king salmon harvest. So certainly I'll have 4 days of the week that I can guide trips. Usually during the summer, I'm trying to reserve trips 7 days a week. If I don't fill some of those days, I have some days off. Now they're the catch and release days. We really haven't had a catch and release fishery that amounted to much on the Little Susitna. This downturn in king salmon is something that's been going on since 2007, or right after 2007, and we've had days in the past on the Little Susitna where it was catch and release fishing. But there was always the Susitna, and specifically the Deshka, which is a tributary to the Susitna, where we could fish 7 days a week. And so I might have been moving around, but I was always going someplace where my guests, if they caught a nice king salmon, they could harvest it. And I always felt that in that type of fishery, that I likely had less impact, or my guests may have less impact than in a catch and release fishery. And
why would that be?
Well, the reason being is the catch and release fisheries, oftentimes there's not all that much participation. A lot of people want to harvest the fish. But if I guide a catch and release trip with my guide boat, and I can move up and down, and I have good ideas of how to catch fish, certainly a lot of experience, the guests may even though, you know, the fishing may not be good, if you can get on a bunch of fish, they may catch a whole bunch of fish.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes when you're catching those fish, you'll hook some that maybe get hooked back in the gills, mm-hmm. and they're gushing blood. So
they're going to die, yeah.
If it's a harvest fishery, you know, that might not even be the fish that the guest wants, but if it's a harvest fishery, okay, guide's decision, this looks like a dead fish. You're keeping this fish. It counts as your limit. You're done fishing.
Mm-hmm.
But typically what happens on my harvest fishery is king fishing is you're working to get bites. Somebody catches a decent fish, a nice fish, 20 or 30-pound fish. For sure, if they catch one that size, I'm telling them, hey, if you want to keep a fish, this would be a really good one to keep. If you let it go, you may not catch another one. And most of the guests, they catch one fish and they're happy. A lot of times, mm-hmm. they might catch just a 10 or 15-pound fish, which is more like the size of a good silver salmon,
mm-hmm.
and they'll keep that, their first fish.
Especially if they're from outside and they've never really been king fishing. And I mean, catching a 15-pound fish is pretty exciting.
Yeah, it kind of depends on who's doing the catching.
Yeah.
You know, like you say, if it's somebody that hasn't caught a king salmon, for sure.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of our guests have not caught a king salmon. Some of them have caught quite a few king salmon.
Yeah.
And when the regulations get tighter, and so in the last several years, most of the time, people have been allowed to keep two king salmon a year from, at least from the Little Susitna. Sometimes it's hopped up on the Deshka during the season. But when the limit gets lower like that, then there's quite an incentive for people that are going very often to put the smaller one back,
right.
and try and keep a bigger one. And that probably has quite an impact on our, you know, if we have low stock and you're harvesting the bigger ones, which tend to be a higher proportion females, you're not helping your spawning success,
right.
when you do that.
So, Andy, you've been there for 35 years in fishing, and obviously you know that the escapement is critical to what happens 5 years from now, and you want there to be fish. So how do you feel about just the fact that fishing is being closed down in terms of a conservation measure? I mean, do you think that it's the wrong decision? Or, and I know I want to talk more about the timing of it and how it was done, but just in terms of the conservation, and assuming the timing had been done right and the process had been done right, would you be okay with the decision on that basis?
It's always a tough decision, mm-hmm. when you know you have to tell people that they can't go fishing, or
yeah.
they can't harvest a fish, especially, you know, in Alaska. A lot of people live here for those opportunities. And, you know, as I mentioned earlier, king salmon is half the summer,
yeah.
in the Mat-Su Valley. There's nothing like king salmon that you can go catch. It's not one of the saltwater fishery where there's halibut or rockfish, you know, nice size rockfish. In the valley, you can go fish the lakes for trout, but it's a lot different experience than catching a king salmon. As far as the conservation of it, I think it would be very good, and I think the department's going this way, to have a plan where if the department has a projection for a low year, conservation measures might be the first step. Can we do this under a more conservative harvest strategy and still allow a fishery? But I think there's a point where definitely, if things look poor enough, the fishery should be closed. No harvest should be allowed. And, you know, if things are poor enough, I think it's a reasonable position to say even catch and release will not be allowed, specifically targeting these fish.
Mm-hmm.
There's still some other fish people may be fishing for in the Susitna drainage, primarily rainbow trout, Arctic grayling,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Dolivard and Arctic char.
Yeah. So maybe it was something that had to happen, and obviously it's debatable and it's a sad decision, but coming when it did has really been a big problem for a lot of people. How is that, having this decision come as late as it did, how has that affected you and other guides, lodges, people in the business?
So it's affected me several ways. I have an article coming out in Fish Alaska magazine that I started contacting the department and the manager specifically that manages the Susitna, started contacting them back in November, putting this article together. The article's passed a deadline, and we're still attempting to make editing changes just because of the impact and what this did. You know, when you're trying an article like that is for the public. It's basically a forecast article of salmon fishing in the Mat-Su. Mm-hmm. Again, king salmon is half of that, approximately. And so just getting that word out now to the public is difficult. Some of the lodging businesses, I've seen some of the letters that were sent to the governor, to the commissioner of fish and game, to legislators. Some of the lodging businesses had most of their summer booked already. One of them, I think, was talking about $300,000 worth of bookings out in the Lake Creek area, something like that.
And so they've probably spent a lot of money not only getting those bookings, but getting ready to open the lodge.
Oh, yeah. You know, certainly he's going to have overhead as far as the people that he's hired and whatnot, whether the fishing's allowed or not. And then as a business, when you get that decision late, you've had people that are contacting you or you've been contacting them. And the assumption is, okay, yes, you're going to be able to harvest king salmon. These are what regulations have been. This is what we're, you know, thinking there is going to be going on. And you just kind of get that rug pulled out from underneath you. The department started their projection for Susitna king salmon quite a while back. I was told we intend to have that by about Christmas. It'd be like an early Christmas present. Hmm. The projection wasn't looking good, and the department just kept it under wraps. But even talking to the manager was telling some of us, you know, giving us some bit of an idea, not totally. My business, I didn't book a lot of trips because I talked to the staff and said, hey, you know, what's going to happen here?
Because you know enough about this fishery to know that it probably was going to be pretty bad.
So the fishery has been operated under restrictive regulations for the last 5 years. When I say restrictive, in pre-season emergency order, which certainly takes the stability out of the fishery. Mm-hmm. We haven't had this kind of closure. I've been in business for 35 years. There's not been nothing like this ever. But in those 35 years, previous to that, there was a time when all of the king salmon fishing was closed. But those regulations, the department always says, well, we'll try and have this out right by the first of the year, or they start getting a little later. But when they start talking about tough changes or restrictions, the department doesn't get them out in a very timely manner. And mm-hmm. so every year, since they went to this strategy of trying to restrict the sport fishery so we could have a full season of fishing or a more full season of fishing, it's been real problematic trying to figure out what the regulations are going to be.
Yeah. My guest is Andy Couch. He has Fishtail River Guides. He's a member of the Mat-Su Borough Fish and Wildlife Commission, writes a column for the Frontiersman, 35 years in the industry, as he mentioned, and many, many other things I could mention. He knows a lot about fishing in the Mat-Su Valley. So we're talking about this closure, very broad closure for king salmon fishing coming up this summer in the Susitna. And in the whole drainage and some of the associated streams also have some pretty severe restrictions, which is really, really affecting that industry up there, and of course affecting a lot of anglers from Anchorage. Do you have a sense of why this delay took place? I mean, you obviously are super involved, but you're not within the government, so I guess you don't really know. But have you picked up from your own belief of why it didn't happen sooner? Because as you said, some other forecasts take place in the fall. So why is this one coming out in the spring?
Well, some of us in the sport fishing industry have the thought that the Department of Fish and Game just kind of considers the sport fishing industry, which is a really big industry and contributes a lot to the economy, as just kind of some kind of game or play thing. It's not a real serious industry like the commercial fishery. That kind of seems to be where the department goes at times. I think another thing is that the managers, they have no idea, or at least they seem to have no idea, how important it is for a business to know ahead of time. And that does not just mean a guide business. You know, our guests come up and they rent vehicles, they purchase lodging either from us or from somebody else. When that reason for renting the vehicle and purchasing the lodging, they buy fishing licenses and king salmon stamps. When all that goes away, it's pretty big time. And the department, in my mind, if you're working for the government and you just have a steady income, you may not know. You may think you know, but you really don't know what kind of impact that has on folks. That's what I think, but I don't know. I mean,
suddenly your year's income is disappearing before your eyes, and maybe you've already laid out money ahead of that to be prepared for it. So when it disappears, yes, it's partly an act of nature, but also just knowing earlier would allow you to prepare and do, you know, have a different strategy.
Yeah, and I think even the department. I was talking to my brother-in-law yesterday, and he said, "Oh, you know, did you notice that the department had a big sales opportunity? They sent something out to fishing and hunting license holders. Oh, wouldn't you like to buy your fishing and hunting license King Salmon stamp?"
Hmm.
They sent that out before the closure with no mention of the closure and restrictions that were going to be in place. And I mean,
your king stamp for the Matsu would be pretty worthless. Yeah.
So some of the Susitna had been restricted before up around mm-hmm. Susitna Landing.
Mm-hmm.
I talked to the owner around Susitna Landing about, or that not the owner, the operator of Susitna Landing at the time. He said the locals would say, "Now wait a minute, I have to purchase a king salmon stamp even though I can't keep a king salmon." They could still catch them and let them go mm-hmm. loose. And the answer is yes. You if you're fishing for king salmon, you need a king salmon stamp. But the locals there didn't buy the salmon stamp and didn't use the landing.
So as you mentioned earlier, it's been quite a few years now that the kings have been low. Has that restricted the amount of effort and the amount of fishing up there? Has it just made it so that it's harder? I mean, what is the impact of this over like the last 5 or 7 years been that you've seen?
Certainly the effort's been down. There's certain portions of the Susitna where it's been down way more than other portions. So the Deshka has remained open. It's remained open 7 days a week. Some years there's been some in-season restrictions or closures that have cut it off. But the park's highway streams, everything on the Susitna drainage upstream from the Deshka, which includes a lot of streams where king salmon fishing is normally been allowed. Since 2013 was the last time there was any harvest in those streams allowed, legal harvest for king salmon. So that place has been affected quite a bit already, mm-hmm. you know. And then the Deshka, the effect on the Deshka has been that since all that other stuff is closed that is fairly easy to get to, there's been a lot more pressure on the Deshka. And the Deshka is a big producer for the Susitna. Maybe 20 to 25% of the king salmon returning to the Susitna drainage go to the Deshka, and it can have more liberal regulations at times, too.
Yeah. So I'm curious, because you know so much about fishing, if you have a theory of what's happened to our kings.
Well, the department would say that we're having poor ocean survival, and mm-hmm. I think that's a logical conclusion. I think it's more than that, you know, as far as the projection being low in the Susitna Valley. The Fish and Wildlife Commission had a meeting with the department last week, maybe even 2 weeks ago now. I'm fuzzy on my time, but the department was talking about poor ocean survival. And it's more than poor ocean survival, because just a ways away on the Kenai River, the department's projecting a good enough return to have king salmon harvest mm-hmm. there to start the season with the early run and with the late run kings. Last year there was a real poor projection for the Copper River Basin, and the sport fishery was closed up there for a while, but the fish showed up pretty good. And the projection this year is they'll start the season with a normal run. So Southeast Alaska, the department's looking at the same kind of scenario that happened here with the very late announcement of likely closures to the Susitna. So there's kind of a hodgepodge. It isn't all just down. I suspect in the Susitna drainage, we had some flooding around 2012, 13 in there. And the flooding seems to affect the Susitna drainage more than it does like the Kenai River, where there's big lakes. It tends to be more stable production.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that freshwater component may have had some kind of impact. And then 2012, which would be parent year for the five-year-old fish that are returning this year, all of Upper Cook Inlet, so everything north of Anchor Point, was declared a federal disaster. And so those returns were low. We had very tight regulations that year. The entire Susitna drainage and the Little Susitna ended up being closed early, as well as the Kenai. There was restrictions to the commercial fishing. That we made goal on the Deshka that year as far as a specific number of fish, but not as many older fish, which are, your females are primarily the older fish. And so you combine that, maybe a escapement that met goal but maybe didn't have the females to produce as many eggs as usual, and then you had the flooding in the fall, and then you have poor ocean conditions, and I would imagine all of those
combination effect.
Of those contribute to a problem.
Well, and we're almost out of time, Andy, but I just wanted to what does your summer look like, and what advice do you have for anglers? I mean, it's pretty dismal, but I just thought I'd give you sort of a last answer here to sort of close it out.
So as far as my guiding, the king salmon season's pretty empty right now.
Yeah.
Most of the people that are making reservations with me are doing it on Monday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, because those are the days that people can harvest fish on the Little Susitna.
Mm-hmm.
If everybody goes to the Little Susitna and takes their boat over there, it's going to be a busy season over there.
Mm-hmm.
Catch rates on the Little Susitna are typically lower than they are on the Deshka.
Yeah.
If there's a lot of people, the catch rates will be lower. The Susitna drainage, the Deshka in particular, there will be 7 days a week catch and release fishing for king salmon, and it's the easiest fishery for people to access relatively mm-hmm. close to the road system. You still need a boat or a plane to get there. I would expect the Deshka may have some pretty good catch and release fishing, because I think that people won't be going over there. They certainly won't be allowed to harvest king salmon. Another thing that is often allowed at the Deshka, standard regulation says bait fishing starts on the 1st of June. That will not be allowed. A lot of people only go to the Deshka when it opens to bait fishing because it makes catching the fish easier.
Right.
So there's
some opportunities out there.
So,
I'm sure some people will be diverting down to the peninsula that would have normally gone up to Matsu.
Yeah, and then the other two opportunities mm-hmm. that are going to be full-blown are going to be the Ship Creek fishery in Anchorage,
right,
and the Iklutna fishery. So people will be allowed to harvest there and be allowed to fish, you know, a lot of hours and use bait. But there's probably going to be significantly more people trying to catch some of those fish.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming in, Andy. I really appreciate your knowledge. It's been really interesting.
Yep. Thank you, Charles.
Andy Couch has Fishtail River Guides, and he's been fishing up in the Matsu and for 35 years and guiding and writes for the Frontiersman. That's all we have on this topic, but stay with us on Outdoor Explorer. We're still talking about more outdoor topics. My name is Charles Wolforth. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolfworth, and it is time for our monthly training calendar when we sit down with Lisa Keller of Multisport Training of Alaska to talk about getting ready for big challenging events in the future, planning your workouts around a goal, such as a marathon or a triathlon. We've been working towards some of these big spring, early summer events, and hopefully, you know, getting in pretty good shape. What's the next big one coming up, Lisa?
Well, the next one I think most people would be looking for, I kind of lump them together, Gold Nugget and Eagle River Triathlon. Mm-hmm. They're within a few weeks of each other. Gold Nugget, of course, is women only. Eagle River has men and women, but I think actually the percentage of women is higher than men at Eagle River, thanks to the Gold Nugget effect, I'll say. So we're in build two for those races, which means we're getting very close to race day. So we have about 7-8 weeks until race day. So a lot of what you're going to do looking for those right now is you're doing those race-specific bricks, which are a little bit different than you were doing for Lava Man because the temperature is going to be different.
This is the bike run combination, right?
Mm-hmm. But in Lava Man, where you wanted to do them in a heated environment, now you may be facing 50 degrees in rain on these days.
Right.
So it's going to be more of what we're used to. So, and they'll also be shorter since these are sprint triathlons instead of Olympic distance.
And what is sprint? I mean, what are the numbers?
So the Gold Nugget and the Eagle River are both a 500-yard swim. The bike is about 12 miles, I think, for both of them.
Mm-hmm.
The Gold Nugget has a little bit longer run than the Eagle River, just over 3 miles. So they're about 3 mile run. But they're challenging, and they're definitely done at a higher intensity for most people. They're also a great way to get into triathlons and learn about them without making the huge commitment of time and money to a longer triathlon.
I'm not going to, and these events that kind of are devastated to your calendar and to your body afterwards.
Right, exactly.
Because like when you do the marathon and the whole thing.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly. So these are a great place to start. So there's a couple of questions for equipment that you have to look at for these two races. So if you're a cyclist who's used to clipping in, having clipless pedals on your bike in a race like Gold Nugget, which is pretty flat and short, you might not do that. You might choose to have a platform with a basket instead. I've always done it because it makes a faster transition.
Mm.
So transitions become very important in these races. Some people still.
If you're futzing around with your shoes, you're going to be losing a lot of time.
Exactly.
It's hard to make up.
Mm-hmm. In Gold Nugget, the transition is a remote location, so you're not coming back to the same place that you started the bike. Eagle River is a little bit different. Hillier, it's a much more technical bike ride. So that's a race where you would want to spend more time preparing on your bike, the technical part of it, and getting used to being on that course that has a lot of turns and hills.
So do the actual course and then practice the actual switch.
Yep, absolutely.
You don't want to, it shouldn't be the first time you do it. It's in race day.
Right, exactly. Yeah, mm-hmm. You got it.
Okay. So looking farther out, the Mayor's Marathon is a big one for a lot of people. Takes place around the solstice.
Mm-hmm.
We're about halfway through our training program for that now, right?
The big thing that you should be doing now is you're up to a long run, probably around 3 hours. There's some debate of whether it's really helpful to go more than 3 hours on long runs. But most people take longer than 3 hours to do that race.
You're probably not going to be able to do the race in 3 hours unless you're a really
good
runner.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So there is some debate about how long you want to make your long run. I get most people up between 3 and 3.5 hours, even if it's going to take them 4.5 hours or 5 hours to do the marathon. But the one thing I think is really important at this phase in your training is that you're adding marathon pace, the pace you want to run that race, you're adding it into your long runs. So you might start with just 30 minutes of marathon pace during that long run. You might divide it up 15 minutes in the beginning, 15 minutes at the end. Then maybe a little bit later you add 15 minutes in the middle. And build yourself up so you're running an hour, depending on how long it's going to take you, maybe even up to 2 hours of marathon pace in that marathon long run.
So you're doing closer to what the actual race is going to be.
Right.
But it seems like one of the tricks with a marathon is like after you run a marathon you're a wreck for quite a while, and if you do that then you're not going to be able to work out and get ready.
Right, that's why you can't go out and run that whole 3 hours at marathon pace. You have to divide that up. So, and it's a road marathon takes a lot more out of your body than like a trail run, a 50k run even.
Right.
So it's just that pounding on the pavement, so you should be doing those long runs on similar terrain.
Would you be practicing your nutrition and how you're going to keep your calories on board during these long runs as well?
Absolutely. It's really tough on just straight runs to get calories in because your stomach really doesn't want to process it. You know, it's upset and, you know, you're jostling it around and it's trying to divert blood to your muscles. So you definitely need to kind of start to dial down exactly how many calories you need. And those calories should be all carbohydrates. In a race like Mayer's, if it ends up being a warm day, you're definitely going to be needing to pay attention to your sodium. So you basically need three things during the race. You need fluid, water, you need carbohydrates, and you need sodium. And the three of those work together to get all those nutrients into your cells. So it's really important to figure out I kind of like to think about it as the least amount of calories I need per hour, and then divide that out and start practicing that.
So you actually do the math.
Oh, yeah. You got to read labels and you got to do the math for sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So how do you find that information out? How do you know how many calories you need?
So there's a range of calories. There are formulas based on your body weight. I also like trial and error. So this is the time to do that trial and error. Is put yourself under real circumstances because everybody's different. And so a formula doesn't always work for everybody. So for instance, I'm a small person. I've settled on about 100 calories an hour while I run. And whether that's in fluid, whether, you know, it's a chew, it's a gel, whatever it is. So that counts everything from I take a 100-calorie goo 5 minutes before the start of the race. So that counts in my whole total. Mm-hmm. And then I try to get every 45 minutes to an hour trying to get
And a goo is this sort of jelly-like substance that comes in an envelope. It's very sweet.
Yes.
But it's easy to get down is the key to it.
It's really easy to get down.
And it has a lot of energy in it.
And, you know, one of the things is it's really good to use your taste buds as feedback. So if it tastes super, super sweet while you're racing, you probably have enough carbohydrates on board. Hmm. If it tastes like, oh, my gosh, this is the best thing I've ever had, then you probably need more, you know, or it's good that you're taking it. So another technique, if you're stomach is upset, we've seen a lot of studies now that show that swishing a sports drink in your mouth triggers your body to think it's getting carbohydrates, and then you don't actually have to put anything in your stomach. So that's actually another race strategy you can use if your belly is upset.
I see, just to settle yourself down.
Yep, exactly.
Because if you don't take in any calories, you may not be able to finish the race.
Exactly. Yeah. So
all right. Well, we're about out of time, but there's some other races for which you will be sort of just getting started. Lost Lake is a big race down on the Kenai Peninsula. Mm-hmm. And then the Running Fest in Anchorage in August is one of our biggest race days of the year.
Yep.
And we've talked about you just getting started and building up some volume, right?
Right. This would be the first month of training for those races.
Great. So we'll talk more about that next month when Lisa Keller will be back for our training calendar. She has Multisport Training of Alaska. You can find her website on ours at outdoorexplorer.org. That's all for Outdoor Explorer. Our producer is Eric Bork, assistant producer Hannah Duro. My name is Charles Wolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and in your favorite podcast app. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.